You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security and our sister podcast, Business and National Security Law. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. And today we have a terrific guest, more than well qualified to talk about Putin and how Trump might deal with him. But first, President Trump just met last week with Russian President Vladimir Putin, a former KGB officer. The original purpose of the meeting was to discuss ending the war in Ukraine, and the meeting was held in Alaska, a U.S. state that once belonged to Russia. At the point of their meeting just days ago, the United States stood as the largest economic power in the world, while Russia has a GDP that is less than 20% of Italy's. Also at the time of their meeting, Russia has seized almost 20% of Ukraine, a country we persuaded to give up nuclear weapons. To level set and talk about how to manage Putin, I'm joined by friend of the cast, Rob Dannenberg. Rob is the author of a fun book on cocktails that are linked to spycraft and history. He's a former CIA agent himself. And he's here like me in his individual capacity, but more important to today's conversation, Rob was twice the station chief in Moscow. Hello, Rob. Thanks for coming.
Well, hello, Lisa. It's very nice to be back again on your podcast, talking about something that's near and dear to my heart. And we should all be paying attention to what's going on right now.
The meeting was really supposed to be about the war in Ukraine, and we call it a war, but the Russian invasion of Ukraine and seizure of part of Ukraine. Did Putin pull a fast one when he added economic sanctions to the topic, given what's happening right now to the Russian economy?
Well, it certainly is a war in every definition of the word. It's the largest war on the European continent since the end of the Second World War. It dwarfs anything that happened in the Balkans in the 80s. The numbers of casualties, depending upon who you believe, run up to a million killed, captured, or wounded on the Russian side, and probably about 40% of that on the Ukrainian side, making it, you know, conservatively, let's call it 1.4 million casualties, military and civilian in the war thus far. That qualifies as a war. And President Trump, as I think anyone who's read the newspapers in the last year or so, has suggested two points relevant to this war. One, that the war would have never started had he been president. And secondly, that he, Trump, would find a way to solve the war, bring about peace in a very short period of time after he took office, 24 hours, 48 hours. I mean, you know, there were different versions of it. The closest manifestation to Trump achieving that promise was to be at the Anchorage summit. No ceasefire, no peace agreement, arguably no progress towards a peace agreement. But I would make the case to you that some things now should be clear to the president of the United States if they weren't clear before. Arguably the most important is that Putin has been stringing him along with discussions, whether in private phone calls or in other fora, a desire for peace and a desire to engage the Ukrainians in a meaningful peace process. Secondly, Putin was prepared to offer some concessions to the Ukrainian side or the U.S. side that would indicate a willingness on the Russian side to move towards a negotiated settlement to the war. And I think if there's anything that should be clear to the president right now is that Putin was never sincere in any of those remarks that he made to him or promises that he made to the president, that whatever was discussed in the meetings between Trump's emissary, Steve Witkoff, and the various interlocutors with whom he met in the Kremlin, including Putin, was pure nonsense. And part of that, I would argue, is a tactical mistake made by the U.S. side in that they went into those meetings with an interpreter provided only by the Russian side, no U.S. interpreter there, or note taker at Steve Witkoff's side, note taker who spoke Russian. So that means whatever the Russian translator was putting in front of Witkoff is what Witkoff took away. And there's a lot about dealing with people in a foreign language in a negotiating context where if you don't speak the language yourself or you don't have an interpreter in whom you have confidence, you're going to miss a lot of what's going on. And clearly, it seems that some of the things that Witkoff took away from the meeting with Putin that indicated Putin's willingness to compromise in various issues, territorial demands, or whatever it might have been, were misinterpreted and improperly relayed to the President of the United States.
I think the president has to approach this with at least a public air of optimism, even if he knows Putin's going to string him along, right? I mean, he can't just enter a negotiation or expect to start a dialogue with somebody who he verbally strafes, and particularly a guy like Putin, who has got an outsized ego. Isn't part of the game that you've learned in your capacity as a CIA agent is to sort of convey this kind of hope? The other thing is, if he starts with no hope, then he has no place to begin negotiations. How would he have pulled that off? I take your point about the interpreter, and hopefully somebody will listen to what you've said and take that step next time. It's like having your own lawyer, you know, it's like a conflict of interest. You ought to have your own interpreter, right? But don't you think that at least publicly, even if the president said, and it's been revealed that he privately said he felt like he was being strung along, that he has to act like there's some possibility here and then try to work things out?
Well, I would argue to you that that's the wrong approach to take with somebody like Putin or negotiating with the Russians in general. Having spent most of my adult life working as part of CIA operations against what we call the Russian target, speaking broadly, but KGB officers in particular, I've got a little bit of a sense for how to approach those people. And one of the things that you should always keep in mind with the Russians is how they look at a problem. Russians look at a problem. There's an old adage in Russian that translates into what's mine is mine and what's yours is negotiable. So that's basically the starting point for Putin or any of the KGB progeny that are engaged in negotiations with the United States. So part of the way to deal with that is actually throw out some pretty hard lines on your side and indicate no willingness to make concessions, but a willingness to escalate. And that's where I think we've made a big mistake. In as far as I can see, in all the engagement with the Russian Federation and with Vladimir Putin as the president of the Russian Federation, since Trump entered office, and perhaps even before he entered office, has all about finding a way to accommodate and to build a relationship with Putin by conceding things in advance of negotiations. That is exactly the wrong approach for dealing with the Russians. And I would also argue that that disastrous meeting in the White House with Zelensky was part of a message that Trump was planning to send or was wanted to send to Putin, that he was doing his part to put pressure on the party that Putin believes is responsible for the war, in the hope that that would bring Russia closer to looking for a way to make a deal with the United States to end this war. I mean, Trump's motives in this thing are genuine in the sense that he wants the fighting to stop. Trump is a commercial guy. He doesn't understand war for the purposes that Putin has started this war. I mean, Trump doesn't, it doesn't make any economic sense. It doesn't make any business sense to Trump. And the killing genuinely means something to Trump. You can say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but you can't call him a warmonger. I mean, you can't credibly call him a warmonger or a guy
No,
who's
I
look.
don't think people do at this point. I think they understand that he's genuine when he says he wants this over.
But I would argue to you that when you're dealing with a guy like Putin, who is a warmonger and is bloodthirsty in the classic sense of the term, and doesn't care how many Ukrainians he kills, civilian or military, doesn't care how many Russian soldiers he loses in the process, you can't take an approach of negotiating with him like you're negotiating with a rational, Western-thinking business partner. And that's the mistake that we've made.
Yeah, but I can also imagine people in the White House, and this is not to defend anybody in this, but the bottom line is I can imagine them sitting around saying, almost nothing works with this guy. Let's throw this up and see if it works. You're right. I think a lot of people in the White House, they're good at business negotiations. They're very talented. And whatever tools that they bring to a negotiation are going to be different from the ones that you need to deploy in a situation like this. My point in raising the issue about the Russian economy and everything else is that we really have a lot of power here. it seems that that's the place where we should start, to your point. And you said something, and I can't remember if I read something that you had written or if I heard you say this, but you mentioned that you thought one thing that the president should consider is immediately deploying the fact that Putin's a wanted man.
Yeah, I actually wrote that in one of the pieces that I did for the Cypher brief. I mean, my suggestion to the president, not that he listens to me or should listen to me necessarily, but was to start the negotiation in Anchorage. First thing the president might have thought about saying to Vladimir Putin is that you're here by my leave. You are a wanted war criminal by the International Criminal Court, and I'm allowing you here for the purpose of conducting a negotiation for ending the war in the Ukraine that you started and for which you are guilty of war crimes. So therefore, Mr. President, that's the basis in which we're negotiating. We're not negotiating here as equals. I am the president of the United States, the country with the world's largest economy, world's most powerful military, and we are culturally more powerful than the Russian Federation by far in any dimension you want to mention. So therefore, we're not sitting here as equals. We're sitting here as you are the invited guest of the superpower. And now, Mr. Putin, I want you to understand that this is what I expect out of you out of this meeting. And if you do not comply, what you risk is facing actually for the first time. The one thing that we haven't done yet in our negotiation with you about how we end this war is put maximum pressure on you. There's a bill pending in the US Congress that would impose significant sanctions on the Russian Federation, particularly the energy sector, and would also go after those countries that buy your hydrocarbons, which by and large are the only thing that keep your economy afloat at this point, Mr. Putin. Secondly, we are prepared to offer massive increase in financial support and military support to the Ukraine, the victim of your aggression. And that will look like the type of tools that will allow them to defend their airspace, and secondly, the type of tools that will allow them to attack targets in the Russian Federation from which you are launching those attacks against civilian targets in the Ukraine. That's, Mr. President, Mr. Putin, is where we are starting these negotiations. Now, what do you have to say? That's how you.
So he didn't do that. He took a different approach. He took the approach that he felt was the right one. Is that because we remain dependent on Russia for things like enriched uranium, and we find ourselves just like we are in the negotiations with China right now, where they're holding back on the rare earths minerals in order to get what they want? Do you think that that was part of the calculus, as well as the fact that India and China continue to do business with Russia behind our backs, and they've proven to be not at all interested in sort of stopping that, despite sanctions and despite threats from the White House? And I would credit the White House with saying, look, India, you're done here. We're going to start sanctioning you because you're purchasing Russian oil. India did not react well, but they already put that out. So there was some follow-up. And the president did run on not being a war president. And if he threatens to escalate, isn't he sort of going back on what he more or less promised, which was not to get us involved in any further conflicts?
There's a lot of stuff there to unpack in your question. The first is our dependence on Russia for enriched uranium. There are plenty of places where you can get enriched uranium around the planet, and including increased mining in the United States. Buying it from Russia at the moment happens to be an easier and more cost-effective solution, but it shouldn't be. We should be actively looking for every way that we can to reduce any form of economic dependency that we have on the Russian Federation. I mean, I would go back to the vehicles that we use to launch our satellites into space. And until SpaceX came along, we almost exclusively pushed our satellites into space with boosters provided by the Russian Federation. Well, we got rid of that by building an American commercial alternative to the Russian provider. We should be doing the same thing with the enriched uranium and any other products that we get from the Russian Federation, which are diminishing in their economic importance to the United States anyhow. Second thing is, what about pressure on countries like India and China? Obviously, those are big trading partners for the United States. And we're just coming out of the COVID era where we encouraged displacement of manufacturing from China to places like India, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, other places, other non-Chinese locations for the production of pharmaceuticals or any of the zillion products that China makes that are sold in the United States right now. And that was sensible. But one of the primary relocation spots for this manufacturing was India. So you got to be a little bit careful about, how you deal with India. But they've got a Prime Minister Modi now who's quite independent-minded. He's in the process of turning himself into another Erdogan or whatever formula you want to put around that for somebody who looks like he's going to be in power for a long time. So you got to be a little bit careful about a guy like that. And he's grown closer with Putin because, the economic relationship from the sale of Russian hydrocarbons to fuel India's economy at the price that they can get them from the secondary market and the primary market is really favorable to India's economy. So Modi, who's trying to keep his economy going, is saying, it looks like the price I have to pay for this is to support this crummy guy in Russia, and he's killing Ukrainians, which the Americans and the Europeans don't like, but I don't really care about. It's a good deal for him. Then you jump over to Xi in China, where we're engaged in very serious trade negotiations about rare earth metals, as you mentioned a moment ago, among many, many other things. And we're trying not to escalate that. I mean, Trump is trying not to escalate that, probably think, and I think sensibly so. It's a complicated equation. And again, Xi is a big friend of Putin's. And I say big friend, and I don't mean that term lightly. They've met over 50 times in the 25 years that Putin's been running the Russian Federation and the years plus that Xi has been running the People's Republic of China. They genuinely have a personal relationship. They speak in common terms about the risk that the United States and Western freedoms pose to the types of governments that they have in their countries. I mean, Putin constantly talks about the United States and the West having fomented these color revolutions on the borders of the Russian Federation. Xi fears that as well. And so they speak in a common language. Xi's not going to give that up because of some threats from Donald Trump on tariffs or whatever else might bite. China says, hey, I got plenty of leverage over the United States as well. I'm willing to use it, which we're now starting to see.
Yeah, and on the topic of enriched uranium, I mean, you have to tell me, I'm under the impression right now that we no longer have any enrichment facilities. And that's the issue, is it's the facility itself. And I don't know if it's like a chip fab that takes, 10 years to bring online or whatever it is, but just sort of given what else the administration seems to be doing on energy, I'd be pretty surprised if they aren't sort of driving in that direction because it seems
They
pretty
should be.
clear and we
That's
shouldn't
why
be depending on
that's
that.
why I brought up the SpaceX example. Just build our own capability to do these things. And if it's enriching uranium, build it.
That's right. And we do need to terminate forever our dependence on Russia for launch. Seems like a lot of this is designed to sort of extricate us from these dependencies over a longer period of time. None of these things happen quickly. So now we've got the issue of the Europeans who are excellent partners, but this White House has a different view. They see that the Europeans have been unwilling, for example, to meet their obligations under NATO. They showed up and they showed up for the purpose of sort of hammering home the view that Putin's not going to stop. Let's say that part of the peace arrangement is that Ukraine gives up this 20% of its territory that's been seized. Another year or two goes by, or even five, that this is going to happen all over again, and he will just continue to advance forward, and that he can't be trusted, that they are the trustworthy and more reliable partners. And it seems like that's the message that they intended to deliver. Of course, they also tried to engage with the president, I think, a lot more than they previously have, and probably tried to meet him where they perceive he is. What do you think about some of those negotiations and the likelihood that Putin's true motive is just to get some sort of incremental assent to, the acquisition of this territory? That would cause the United States to put less pressure on him for a period of time, maybe release some of the sanctions. What do you think? What's going on here?
Let's start with the first question. What about that follow-up meeting on the Monday after Anchorage in the Oval Office, which I think many of us expected was going to be another ambush and embarrassing scene where President Trump, having had his ear filled in on the Friday before in Anchorage by Putin of how Ukraine is responsible for this war and it's Ukraine is the obstacle to peace, I think a lot of us expected that there would be less dramatic, but equally embarrassing for the United States, confrontation between President Trump and Vladimir Zelensky. It didn't happen, in part, I think, because of the amazing solidarity that was shown by many of our European leaders, many NATO leaders, rallying behind Zelensky, cutting off their August summer vacations and flying to Washington on short notice to stand together with Zelensky in front of the President of the United States and say, this matters to us and it matters to the world. I think it was a very powerful statement. And it followed up on the success that European leaders and NATO leaders experienced in the last NATO summit in The Hague, where it seems that somebody finally got together with the NATO heads of state and said, listen, this is how you deal with the President of the United States. You don't confront him and argue with him. You flatter him and maneuver him and get him moving in your direction. And they did that extraordinarily successfully in The Hague and got, and as a result, you got something that Trump could walk away, which is actually really meaningful. That was a commitment on the part of the NATO country, is to spend up to 5% of GDP on defense, 3% of which was going to be on hard stuff. Hard stuff means like gear, not salaries and, you know, benefits, stuff like that. But gear, tanks, airplanes, artillery shells, 3%. That's a big jump. The previous commitment under the NATO agreement was 2.5% of GDP, with no specification for what was going to be spent on hard stuff, what was going to spend. You could be building maternity wards. I don't know what the hell you could be doing. You came away from The Hague with 5% of GDP and 3% of that going to be on hard stuff. That's a big win. And it, you know, I think it's a win for the world, it's a win for NATO, and it's a win for the president. And the way you got there was by the European leaders, NATO leaders, learning how to deal with President Trump, which Putin learned way on in Trump's first term. Getting back to Monday in the Oval Office, the European leaders continued that trend of pushing all the right messages at President Trump. And President Trump responded well, and I think appropriately. These are our true friends. Zelensky is the victim here. And what you had was not a confrontation and an embarrassment for the United States, but a really positive affirmation of the solidarity of the Western alliance, which for all the headlines after Anchorage, I mean, I don't know if you read Russian newspapers, I do, you know, it was all about Putin's triumph in Anchorage. I mean, Russian press was almost mocking of President Trump for his weakness and his subservience to Putin. I mean, this is inappropriate commentary on the Russian press part, but it's there, you can read it. You know, the smirks on Russian faces must have been wiped off after Monday's meeting in the White House with Trump and Zelensky and the NATO leaders standing shoulder to shoulder and sending a message, now we're behind you, Mr. Zelensky. I mean, that's a really powerful, powerful message, I think.
Yeah, and visually, it was incredibly symbolic. The other thing is that I did notice that at least financial newspapers in Europe and some of the French newspapers were also covering the fact that they are now, some of the former defense contractors in these countries are back online and producing materiel. It seems from the articles that I read that they were actually doing this before the summit. They were doing it because of what they have seen with Putin. So I think the desired effect of full engagement and commitment from the NATO partners, at least it looks like it's on the way to being achieved. But I think always an issue is whether or not Ukraine would ever be considered for membership in NATO. Because going back years, Putin remains outraged and always felt like NATO was sort of moving forward and encircling him. And there were promises made to Russia very early on in this, I think by Bush, correct me if I'm wrong, that there, you know, NATO would not expand. And it continued to under the Clinton administration right up until recently, honestly. And I think Putin continues to raise that as an issue, like a pressure point for him. It's the one thing he does not want to see. Is that fact something that could be used in negotiations with Putin to any success? Or is that playing with fire and will just provoke him?
I'm honestly pretty tired about people being worried about provoking Putin. He should be worried about provoking us. That's my point of view. And this stuff about promises on the eastward expansion of NATO. Where do you want to begin marking history? You know, the Russians, Putin would like to start history from 1710 at the maximum extent of the Russian Empire, but then they want to run it from 1989 and promises that they made. You can argue about this stuff endlessly and without meaning. Why is it a threat to the Russian Federation that these countries became part of a military defensive alliance that had preserved the peace, frankly, throughout the entire Cold War? And all of a sudden, it's a threat to Russia, the country that had invaded those countries previously? I mean, that's nonsense. I mean, if you have any kind of a competent American Secretary of State or President, you just turn right around and Putin and say, that's a bunch of nonsense. No, you're the aggressor here. You're the country that these people in this part of the world fear, and they need to be protected. And guess what? We're the people that are going to protect them. Again, backwards in your question, you're like, what's Putin really after here? You know, how much territory is enough? I would argue to you that history is instructive in this respect. I mean, you go back to Munich, 1938. He just wants the Sudetenland. He wants part of Czechoslovakia, and we'll have peace in our time. Well, no, you don't. And the same thing happens here. If you let Putin get away with the annexation of Crimea and the establishment of these people's republics in Luhansk and Donetsk, and I would invite you, Lisa, or any of your friends who are listening to this podcast, go visit those wonderful people's republics and tell me what you think. Walk around the streets there and see, are the people walking around carrying flowers and happily engaging in commerce? No, they're not. I mean, it's a miserable, occupied part of the world. And I feel sad for the people that have been condemned to live under Russian occupation in that part of the world. You know, Putin wants territory, and we're supposed to put pressure on the president of Ukraine to concede this territory. Well, first of all, it's against the Ukrainian constitution. It would cost Zelensky his job. And we want him to do that. It would be illegal in the first place. No international court would recognize. I mean, you guys are the lawyers. I'm not going to argue about this point of law, but I don't believe any court in the world would recognize annexation under the type of pressure that. And who is it for us to tell the Ukrainians to concede anything? I mean, Putin's big demand was, I want all of Donetsk. Okay, great. Well, you know, the part of Donetsk that's not yet occupied by the Russians holds the most significant defensive line on the Ukrainian front line. And by the way, there's 200,000 Ukrainians that live in unoccupied Donetsk. What is Zelensky going to do? So I'm going to turn around and turn 200,000 of you over to Russian occupation. I hope
he can't do it.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.